You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 289.
On today's show, we talk about ancient Focaccia, Mayan fishing canals, and solving one of the Mayan calendars.
Let's dig a little deeper and find some Focaccia. I don't know. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Hello.
All right. We have two-thirds of a theme because two of them are Maya and the other one is not. But whatever.
You know, they don't have to be. Not everything needs to be themed.
This first article, Rachel, I'm sure was triggered because she probably wasn't even looking for archaeology stuff. She was probably literally Googling Focaccia.
I probably was. Yeah. I've been on this like bread making thing lately, specifically
sourdough. For most people, that was COVID. For you, that was 4 years later.
I don't know why I missed the boat during COVID. Maybe it's because we were moving into an RV and like learning to live in an RV was enough of a challenge at that moment. And I just like couldn't take on like learning how to bake sourdough bread when the rest of the world was doing it.
I know. But some people during COVID just like sat around in their house and watched TV and baked bread and learned crafts. And we did that for about 3 or 4 months, got bored, bought an RV and sold our house.
Yeah. And like figured out how to live on the road. So that there was a lot of time just dealing with that. But I am on the sourdough train now, mostly due to my wonderful friend, Heather Boyd, who, if any of you guys have listened to the Historical Yarns podcast, you recognize that name because she was my co-host on that show and just one of my best friends in the whole world. But we visited her when we were in Vermont and she has a lovely, thriving sourdough starter and she gave me some of it. And now I am off and running and I can't resist anything about bread when I see it. Even if it's not sourdough, I'm like reading about it. And this story is about focaccia and I've been making sourdough focaccia. So there we go. There's the connection. That is why we are doing this article right now.
I don't think I realized until just now reading this article that focaccia is not always sourdough. Focaccia is just a style of bread.
No, I've been making it with
You've been making sourdough focaccia, but
yeah,
I imagine a lot of times when you have focaccia, it's not sourdough.
No, I think most of the time it's not. Like when you buy it at the store, because that tangy, like slightly sour flavor that are in the ones that I make, it's because of the sourdough starter, but it's not always like that.
Well, what's also not sourdough is the focaccia in this story.
Well, maybe not. Although,
well, they mentioned cereals and grains.
They did.
But that has sourdough in it. But they also don't have yeast. So.
But yeah, like side note, like I don't really know a lot about ancient bread baking, right? But they didn't have little packets of yeast that they could just go buy at the store.
Yeah, this
so
probably was a sourdough.
It was probably
type of thing.
Some. Yeah,
they the same technique though.
They would have to culture their yeast in some way.
And well, grow the yeast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But well, they were growing it. They didn't know they were doing it, basically.
Oh, maybe. Maybe.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Honestly, we would have to do a whole lot more research into this. And maybe that's a little theme podcast we'll do down the road at some point to figure out.
Good.
Like.
Good.
Oh, so, I'm sorry. Did you not like all the bread I've been baking lately and how into it I'm getting?
No, the scale does not like all the bread you're making. My mouth does.
No, this is healthy because I make it at home.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. That is a whole other conversation we could have. It's like saying the paleo diet was healthy because, you know, they lived to 30. Anyway.
Okay, moving on.
Yes.
All right.
So.
Okay, let's talk about this old school focaccia.
Right. So archaeologists from Rome and a partner called UAB and a few other universities we'll mention in a minute here found evidence of baking of large loaves of bread and focaccias in the Fertile Crescent area of the Near East. If you're going to bake anywhere, it better be in the Fertile Crescent.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's where like so much of this started, right?
Yeah.
So it just makes sense that we would have this early evidence there.
Yeah. The cool thing is they even had different flavors and cooked them on special trays called husking trays.
I know. I'm like, where do I get a husking tray? Clearly I need one of these.
I mean, if you want a gritty bread, I'm sure. Every time I think of people cooking in ceramic stuff back in the day,
No,
sure, when you fire it smooth, it's going to be real nice. But come on, there had to be some grittiness in just like everyday food.
I don't think so. I think that process that they used to really smooth out the inside of a ceramic pot before they fire it made it really smooth.
Yeah.
Well, anyway,
well, the study also included researchers from the Mille et Fontenelles Institution and the University of Lyon in France.
Husking trays were containers with a large oval base and low walls made of coarse clay.
Yeah.
And these were different than common trays internally. They were marked with rough impressions or incisions arranged repetitively and regularly.
Yep. I would imagine that was maybe for, like, so the bread didn't stick, maybe?
Airflow or something.
Airflow. Yeah. They're nonstick ceramic baking dishes. I don't know.
Wow.
Why not? No, I'm serious. Like, if you have the striations underneath there.
Yeah.
But would the bread really stick anyway to ceramic?
No, it wouldn't.
Yeah.
It would, if you put enough oil and stuff in it, and it sounds like they had a pretty solid process for making this bread.
Well, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Previous experiments proved they were or could be used for baking. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. And they suggested that the large loaves were made with flour and water, and they were, you know, placed on these trays for baking.
Yeah. Flour and water. That's basically sourdough right there.
Yeah. Flour, water, sourdough starter, and salt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were placed in a domed oven and baked at 420 degrees Celsius for a couple hours. At least it started. They said it started at 420°C when they like had it up hot. But when you put something in it, it'll cool down and then that will change around.
And for the Americans among us, 420 degrees Celsius is approximately 788 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, but over like a couple hundred, you're just going to be burned to a crisp. So don't worry about it.
Yeah, like super hot. I just had to know, like, what does that mean? Because, yeah, like, I'm just thinking about my own sourdough bread baking journey. And you actually don't, you cook it at a pretty high temperature, but definitely not that high. So,
well, like they said, they would get it up to that height in this, you know, something around there, at least in the experimental trials. That's what the heat would get up to. You know, people don't want to burn shit, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm willing to bet that the ancient people probably had some other techniques for, you know, reducing the heat, cooling it down.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, maybe not letting it get that hot to begin with.
Right.
Something like that. Maybe that just doesn't hold in the archaeological record.
Right. Well, one other thing they found is that the size of the loaves suggests a communal consumption. So if they're baking these large loaves, they might need it to be a higher temperature in order to get it just cooked all the way through.
Yeah, they had ceramic fragments of these husking trays and analyzed them. The ones they analyzed were from between 6400 and 5900 BCE to see if they could have been seasoned with things like animal fat or vegetable oil.
Yeah.
And the fragments of the ones they found were specifically from sites in an area between Syria and Turkey.
Yeah. They analyzed phytoliths, which are silica residues from plants, and found that cereals such as wheats or barley were reduced to flour and then processed in the husking trays. And some of those trays were used to cook foods containing animal-derived ingredients such as fat and, in at least one case, plant-based seasonings.
Seasoned focaccia.
So we definitely have all the ingredients for bread here. We've got cereals like wheat and barley, which you could use to make bread. And then we've got the fat component. And you really do have to have that to keep it from sticking to the trays. Just like you said, you've got to have something to, you know, create a nice, like, liquidy, oily layer.
Yeah.
And they've got it.
And one of the reasons they know that the cooking temperature was pretty high on these things was they can actually tell from the degradation of the residues, those oil and fat residues. They can tell by how much they're degraded, like what temperature they were actually cooked to get to that level of degradation through experimentation. And that temperature is consistent with experimental evidence.
Right.
Yeah. So that high temperature we quoted was not just the experimenters not knowing how to control their oven.
Right.
It was, you know, they know it was that high, at least at some point in the cooking process.
Yeah, totally.
But obviously you'd burn your bread if it stayed that high. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting, but it could be that they just get it up to that temperature and then let it slowly cool. And the bread is cooking as that oven is slowly cooling down too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They also mentioned, and I don't know if this was a misinterpretation of the article or what, but they talked about use wear and use alterations analysis of the ceramic surface, indicating use wear associated with bread residues and others linked to seasoned focaccia residues. And I'm thinking, did the residues or something cause the, like, some sort of degradation of the ceramics, like something like that? And they could see that. I really didn't understand what they were talking about there.
What do they mean by use wear? Do they mean
exactly?
Yeah.
What, like, do they mean?
Yeah. That is an interesting word, because usually you're looking at some kind of
physical
pattern.
Use.
Yeah. Physical, something physical on, and this is on the ceramics. So are they seeing, like, evidence of, like, cutting of seasonings or something like that? So all this proves that communities use cereals they cultivated to prepare breads and focaccias seasoned and enriched with various ingredients and consumed in groups.
Much like we do 9,000 years later.
I know, like, not a lot different. 9,000 years, that seems a little bit.
Well, it said 9,000 years ago. Oh. Yeah, this was 5,900 BC.
Oh.
6,300 BC.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
9,000 years they've been making focaccia.
Yeah.
And then it took 6,000 years for the people in Pompeii to make pizza out of it.
Well, I don't think it was... Okay, we've talked about this. It wasn't actually pizza. It was just like a flatbread with stuff on it, which is
Called pizza.
Which is basically what pizza is.
Right. They just over-seasoned it.
We literally took the focaccias I've been making and turned them into pizza because it's just like you just put stuff on it and then all of a sudden it's pizza.
We made Pompeii pizza.
We made Pompeii pizza, sure. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
The use of the husking trade shows the development of a culinary tradition that developed over about six centuries, according to archaeological evidence.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the one thing that I took away from this, I think it was in the very, very end of the article, is that regardless of how they did it or why they did it, they were baking huge, large batches of bread, right? And they were using this to feed tons of people, which just proves a growing community that was just getting bigger and bigger. And when you have more people, you're getting more advanced. It's just the whole advancement of the society was happening. So, yeah.
There you go.
Yep.
All right. Well, you know, it goes well with focaccia. Baked fish.
It kind of does, actually. Well, like they were sardines and stuff, you know?
They were catching plenty of it in Belize, the predecessors of the Maya 4,000 years ago. We'll talk about that in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 289. And now we're going to talk about the Maya, of course.
Because the Maya are awesome, right? Yeah. Like, why wouldn't we talk about them all the time?
But it's not actually the Maya that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's the predecessors of the Maya, which is super cool because, you know, they didn't just become the Maya and start building pyramids.
Right.
So there was a history there. But to get there, using drones and Google Earth, archaeologists discovered a 4,000-year-old network of earthen canals in Belize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like you said, this is long before the Maya and before the people became the Maya. So,
yeah. Now, I'm not sure if those people actually did become the Maya. I actually wrote that in the notes, but I was just assuming that maybe someone were left there. But then there was talking about the Maya actually moving into that area at some point.
Okay.
After
so they might have
Maya.
Moved in. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of like population migration throughout Central America, obviously. So, but they are in the area that the Maya eventually did occupy. Mm-hmm. So,
and we're going to talk about some stuff here, but there's actually a lot of really good pictures in this article, and they actually, the New York Post, to their credit, who did this article, pulled in some actual images from the journal.
They did. I loved that. Yeah. You don't usually see people doing that because honestly, like journal images and figures can be kind of hard to interpret.
Yeah.
And these are not the easiest to interpret I've ever seen, honestly.
No.
But they do give you a nice idea of what they're talking about here.
Yeah. And you can see in some of these images, the zigzag pattern of canals that they were talking about. And you literally can't see these just sitting on the ground.
No,
you
there's
need
no
aerial
way.
Imagery to be able to suss this stuff out.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And of course, they did do some ground truth with digs in the specific areas that they identified from the aerial images.
Yeah, and ground truthing, for those of you that don't really know what we're talking about here, that really just means they took some hot spots or some areas that, you know, maybe in the canals or something like that, that they could actually just dig some holes, right? Because anytime you find something through aerial imagery or through some other non-excavation sort of way, even if it's ground penetrating radar or something, you have to ground truth it, which just means dig.
Yeah, because what you can see on the surface doesn't necessarily mean there's anything below it. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's cultural, too. There's a lot of things that are natural that happen naturally that people didn't do at all. And you just have to verify.
Right.
But they did find stuff.
Yeah.
So the ancient canals with holding ponds that they identified in these digs were used to channel and catch freshwater species such as catfish.
Yep. They were likely built by semi-nomadic people in the Yucatan coastal plain as early as 4,000 years ago.
Which is so long ago.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And then the canals were probably used, just from what we're seeing here, for about 1,000 years or longer.
Yeah. I mean, if there's a good thing in place and it still works, why wouldn't they just keep using it, right?
Yeah, totally.
Now, this includes the formative period when the Maya began to settle in permanent farming villages and their distinctive culture started to emerge, basically. So even if the people who built these canals weren't the actual precursors to the Maya, it sounds like the Maya would have moved into the area. And if those other people had gone, they would have just used these canals if they were there, right?
I bet the Maya thought it was aliens.
They thought it was the Romans, probably.
And then the Maya were like, apart from these canals, the water system, and the fish, what else have the Romans given the Maya?
I even set you up for that one. I don't know why I'm supporting you putting this quote into every single podcast forever going forward.
I'm just gonna record that and just drop it in.
I really need to watch that movie. It's been so long since I've seen it. Anyway,
large scale landscape modification like this and this early is in this area is very interesting and very rare.
Yeah.
They just don't see this kind of thing. And it might be, I mean, I'm wondering, is it because they haven't looked right?
Like, well, right?
Who just did some aerial imagery stuff and some Google Earth searching?
I mean, this area is jungle, a lot of it. So it just gets so overgrown. And also there's a lot of agriculture too that would have just wiped out things, you know, before researchers had a chance to look at it.
I mean, can you even make that statement? Because I pulled that directly from the article. Can you even make that statement if you've got a series of canals pre-Maya that were used for 1,000 years? You tell me they didn't make anything else?
Yeah.
They're like, oh, we're good with canals. We're going to stop with this large-scale landscape modification tech.
The Maya, at the height of their civilization, built roads, pyramids, and other monuments, obviously. They had complex systems of writing, mathematics, and astronomy. They had so much going on. So there's nothing to say that these earlier peoples didn't have the beginnings of some of those things that were going to eventually, you know, develop. But I guess we still need to find the evidence, right? So
they're showing at the very least this shows a continuity with the past and the predecessors of the Maya, at least the people that used to live there, whether they became Maya or not. And the fish trapping in this area helped people in the region diversify their diets as well and feed a growing population because there was just more and more of them. So
It's just like in the last article, like the more resources you have, the more a population can grow. Right. So being able to trap fish like this, if only they had had focaccia, like they really would have been like,
I'll tell you what,
on a roll. Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess, how did they know like when the fish were coming around? Well, they would need some kind of calendar, wouldn't they? This is actually super cool. On the other side of the break, we're going to talk about how some scientists actually finally solved the mystery, or at least they think they have, of how the Mayan calendar works. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 289. And now we're going to talk about one of the Mayan calendars. And it's one of the long count. I think it is the long count calendar, like the big one.
Yeah.
Because they have a number of calendars.
Well, this calendar is 819 days or 819 day cycle. So if it's not the long count, then I don't know how long the long count is.
I thought they had one that went like 26,000 years, but I could be wrong. Anyway, they didn't really talk about which calendar this was or what it's actually called. That's not really the important bit here, but it is one of the calendars that have been confusing people for a really long time. So it looks like now that this calendar matches up to planetary movements over a 45-year span.
Which is just crazy. It's like such a long span of time. So it's crazy that they built a calendar around that. But it makes me wonder if calendar is even the right word. We're going to get into like what they're actually tracking here. But like
calendar.
Are they really tracking time or is it just like there's some guys that were super interested in the planets and they just like wanted to know like what the movements were. So they just like planned it out.
Could have been some women.
I'm using guys to mean a group of people. Okay. Anyway.
Yeah. So prior research tried to show planetary connections because to be honest, anytime you have a long time frame on something that you know is a long time frame, generally you're probably thinking astronomical observations. I mean, that's just how things work that way.
Yeah.
But anyway, they tried to show planetary connections to this calendar, but the 4-part color directional calendar is too short to fit well with the synodic periods of the visible planets. And that was a word that I'm not sure I had heard too much in the past.
Me either.
Yeah. I'm sure I had with all the astronomy stuff I kind of pay attention to, but anyway, synodic period of a planet is the one thing they would have been able to do without telescopes, because what that actually means is if you've got some kind of a reference point, when you see that planet, you know, with the tip of a certain tree or at the tip of your pyramid or something like that, when that planet, the Earth rotates around the sun and the other planets are rotating around the sun.
Right.
So because of that, the planets have this journey across the sky through time, right? And the amount of time it takes that planet to go all the way around its cycle and come back to the same point, and it may even just revolve up in the sky depending on which planet it is, right? It might not actually disappear during certain seasons, but
like it might just make a big loop in the sky, but as long as you have a reference point for when it starts, or for for when it starts, you can get the length of time it takes for it to make that revolution, whatever it is.
But they would have known, just like some of the other stars in the sky, but the stars all move. The planets would have been different.
Yeah.
And this is why people were confused by planets in the past. In fact, I think the word planet has a Greek root of like wanderer or something like that. I can't remember what that was. But anyway, they talk about how the planets are just different from the stars. When you look at the stars on a fixed background, the planets move differently. And but when it comes back to that point, that's the synodic period.
Yeah.
So
it totally makes sense. And then, of course, they wouldn't have been tracking just one planet, right?
Yeah.
So they would have been potentially looking at all the planets.
All the visible planets.
All the visible planets.
Which and, go out to Jupiter, Saturn.
Yeah.
You know.
And they would have had no trouble distinguishing between those different planets, you think? I mean, I guess not, obviously, if they're tracking them.
Well,
but
you got people that are just watching the sky every single night. There's no lights.
Yeah, I guess so. And you like know? They're slightly different colors or different sizes, and they're
planets
able
look
to
different.
Yeah.
And when you're really fixated on the sky and you grow up just looking at it, you start to realize that certain lights in the sky, regardless of how, what you even know those are, they wouldn't even probably have conceived of the fact that they were other bodies.
Yeah,
what do they even think they were?
They definitely wouldn't have considered them planets, right? They couldn't have distinguished.
They don't know what that means.
Shape. Yeah, they just saw a different looking light, basically.
Yeah, and it behaved differently.
Yeah.
So this was an attempt to map that, because they probably thought by mapping this sort of thing and putting it in this calendar, they were probably getting closer to the gods or something like that.
Yeah, so it probably did have some kind of, you know. Yeah. I'm not, maybe not quite ritual, because I don't know that they were necessarily doing rituals around it, but it might have had some kind of significance in whatever their spiritual beliefs were.
Well, the disconnect here was that the 819-day pattern wasn't enough to match all the synodic periods of all the planets, a few of the planets, but not all the planets.
Yeah.
And so, but they still couldn't work out the 819 days. They're like, okay, so this doesn't quite match up, which means this is probably not right.
Yeah.
But somebody got super smart about this. And when you increase the calendar length to 20 periods of 819 days,
right,
then a pattern does emerge with the synodic periods of all the visible planets commensurate with station points in the larger 819-day calendar.
Man, they were just so smart, but it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Like, if they were, they mapped out all of these planets, right? And then they needed something smaller, so they condensed it down as much as they could, and that's where they got to this 819-day thing. It completely makes sense when you start thinking about it.
Yeah, they had various calendar types, but this one has confused people the most.
Yeah.
Just because they couldn't figure out what was going on there.
Yeah.
So the 20 periods basically is about 16,380 days. Well, it is 16,380 days. That's 819 times 20.
Yeah.
Or 45 years, give or take.
Right.
Yeah. And that's 20, as I said, 819 day timelines. So let's talk about this a little bit. The different planets they could see. Mercury's synodic period of 117 days matches nicely into the 819 days. From there, though, you need longer spans.
Okay.
Mars may be the reason for the ultimate length of the calendar.
Okay.
Because it has a 780-day synodic period.
Yeah.
So in order to start mapping where it's going to be year after year, you kind of just need a longer calendar.
Yeah.
You know, to say that. 21 periods of 708, 21 periods, not 20, of 780 days match exactly the 16,380 day length of the calendar, or 20 cycles of 819 days.
Right.
Yeah. So 21 Mars periods equal 20 819 day calendars.
Okay.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
It's cool. It's a little confusing, but and now Venus needs 7 periods to match 5 819 day counts. So it fits in there.
Mm-hmm. And Saturn has 13 periods that fit within 6 819 day counts.
And finally, Jupiter has 39 periods to hit 19 819 day counts.
Yeah.
So that is kind of confusing, but you're looking at how many times these planets revolve around whatever their fixed point is within the 20 of the 819 day counts. It's kind of confusing when you think about it.
Yeah, like how do you know what cycle you're on?
Yeah.
It must have been within the calendar somewhere.
They must have been tracking each one individually and then they were able to compile them together in a way that is like way smarter than anything I could ever do in my life.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. I'm guessing when they saw Mars for the 21st time, they start the calendar over again. Because that is,
I guess,
you know, that is the end of 45 years. Mm-hmm. That's the end of 20 cycles of the 819 day count.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Maya astronomers who created the 819 day count envisioned it as a larger calendar system that could be used for predictions of all the visible planets' synod periods, which is, again, super crazy.
I know. It's just so like forward thinking. I love that because, I mean, I know a lot of different cultures around the world used the stars and the sun and the moon to track things and make a calendar of sorts, but this just seems so smart, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's just like a level up. I love it. It's so cool. This gives me another thought too, because you and I are kind of struggling to talk about this a little bit because it is like really confusing, right?
Mm-hmm.
which makes me think that this knowledge would have been something that not every single, like, everyday Mayan person would have had access to.
Would have been specialized for
sure. Yeah, it definitely would have been specialized, which tells you that you've got a culture that is definitely, like, split between higher and lower people who have this greater knowledge and those that don't. It would have contributed to, like, a class distinction and stuff like that. So you're talking about a really advanced society, obviously, who's coming up with stuff like this, because it's just not something that everybody can wrap their daily brains around.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I'm definitely specialized information that you can only do if you've got a larger state level society.
There's somebody supporting the people who are putting so much time and effort into creating something like
this. These guys aren't farming.
No, they're spending all their time just understanding this, and it's important enough to these people as a whole, that whoever is in charge of this does this work. It's just so advanced, and I love it.
They call them Maya astronomers too, which, sure, if you study the sky, but I'm willing to bet they were probably part of the religious orders as well, because anytime you compare astronomy or astronomical observations, it's wizardry.
It completely is.
So,
but gosh, just so advanced, these people. I love it.
Yeah, and this calendar also matched up with the commensurate points in the cycles with the Sulcan, I can't remember, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, just read the article, calendar, and the calendar round, which were two of the main calendars.
Yeah.
So
they matched up together. They all worked together, basically, or they could work together if you had the right knowledge to read them, you know? Yeah.
Okay, well, that's it for that. Our next episode is going to be not a movie review, but we actually saw with our little nieces and nephew yesterday, Moana 2.
Yeah, we did.
Which I gotta say,
it was so cute.
That is probably one of the most well done, culturally authentic movies. And I did a little research and found out why. Disney actually did some stuff to make that happen, to their credit. And I figured it was a good excuse to study some Polynesian history.
Yeah. So we're kind of having a deep dive episode into these peoples, which we haven't done a deep dive episode like this in a while, but it was tipped off by watching this movie and trying to figure out what they did right and what they did wrong. So go see the movie if you want to or have access to it before next week. And then we're going to talk about it. And even if you don't have a chance to see the movie, it doesn't matter. It's a kid's movie. We won't really spoil anything, and you'll enjoy hearing a review of it, I am sure.
Indeed. All right. Well, with that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.